Welcome to Ring of Fire. I'm Farron Cousins. We've got a lot coming up. There has been some major news over the past week, including, of course, the Durham court filing that allegedly shows that Hillary Clinton somehow managed to infiltrate and spy on Donald Trump's White House. We're going to bring you the real details of what that court filing actually says. And of course, Donald Trump this week was dumped by his accounting firm Mazars because they said that the information they have from him is no longer reliable. And at the same time that news was breaking, there was a court decision that absolutely puts his kids smack dab in the middle of an investigation going on in Washington, D.C. We'll tell you all about both of those stories. And we're going to revisit our recent conversation with author David Pepper after a slew of states across the country have continued to pass legislation that could dramatically transform this country. And don't forget, you can sign up to become a member of this podcast. Go to rofpodcast.com and you can get fresh content from Ring of Fire every single day of the week. Just go to youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. And of course, you can follow me across all of social media, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I'm at Farron Balanced. So I wanted to give everybody a quick heads up here. Obviously, this week's show is not exactly what we had planned, not exactly what we had wanted. 2 weeks ago, our producer here, executive producer, manager, Scott Milliken, came down with COVID. He is finally, as of today, he has tested negative. It was a rough 2 weeks. It was very hard, you know, for us to get anything done. As I always tell people here, we're a team of two. It's myself and it's Scott. And we've both been here, been doing this since 2004, since the very beginning of Ring of Fire. And so when one of us is out like that, obviously that takes priority. So we also, unfortunately, just kind of one of those weeks, we ran into quite a few tech issues. We had a lot of guests that ended up canceling on us. So this week's show, again, a little bit weird, but we still have plenty to talk about. And so let's get into that right now. So conservative media started buzzing this past weekend after the special prosecutor, John Durham, submitted his court filing last week showing allegedly that a lawyer who worked for the Clinton campaign also somehow managed to spy on the Trump White House and, of course, Trump Tower. And that was quite the shocking admission right in this court filing. So conservative media takes it, runs with it, say we now have definitive proof that Hillary Clinton spied on Donald Trump, thereby validating Donald Trump's claim that they wiretapped me. All across social media, the hashtag Trump was right began trending. In fact, Hillary for prison was also trending. Conservative media thought that they had the slam dunk, the smoking gun they have been waiting for to finally take down Hillary Clinton, right? Well, not so much. And that's why towards the end of the week, the news started kind of disappearing because more people actually looked at what was said in that court filing. So to understand it, first we have to talk a little bit about who Michael Sussman is. Michael Sussman is an attorney who had worked with the Clinton campaign. He has been indicted by Durham, was indicted actually last fall for lying to investigators. So what did he lie about, right? Well, that's a serious crime. He lied about what clients he was representing, okay? So it's not even like he was lying to cover up some kind of big thing. They asked him, are you representing this client? And he said, no, I'm not representing that client. But they believe, no, we think you were. We have evidence to suggest you were. You're indicted. That's it. Like, that's literally the extent of the wrongdoing of Michael Sussman. And sure, you lied to investigators, of course, allegedly lied to investigators. If you did, you got to pay the price. I have no problem with that. To be honest, I have no problem with Durham's investigation, to be perfectly clear with you. You know, he was hired 400 some odd days ago, by the way, to look into the origins of the Russia investigation. And I've supported this investigation, not because I think there was wrongdoing, but because the opposite. Because Durham's final report is actually going to show that, yeah, they didn't do anything wrong. Suck it up. You lost. So that's why I'm totally okay with Durham doing this. Yeah, it's a waste of tax dollars, and that sucks. But it's going to show that they're a bunch of fools for thinking there was a there. So anyway, Sussman gets indicted. Says he wasn't working for this client, but in fact he was. And with his role with the Clinton campaign, he had to invoice them for time. Right. I'm working with them. You know, they have to pay me because I've done stuff for them. So I had to invoice them for time. Otherwise, it would be considered an in-kind campaign contribution. You get into all those weird laws. But yes, so he invoices them. So he's officially, you know, getting paid for the work he's done with them. But at the same time, he also has another client called Neustar. Now, Neustar is a technology firm. And one of the things that Neustar had been doing, and this is where that court filing comes in, is they'd been monitoring traffic, web traffic, phone traffic, internet signals, phone signals coming in and out of the White House, yes, of Trump Tower. And they believe that these signals, based on the addresses and, you know, the digital signatures that they could find, were coming from Russian cell phones that were also linked to a bank called Alfie Bank, which, of course, has ties to the Kremlin. Now, this is all starting to sound very conspiratorial, right? But trust me, it makes sense in a moment. So anyway, Sussman, being an attorney for Neustar, they went to him with his data and they said, hey, listen, you know, we've got info here that says that there's information coming from Russian cell phones to Trump Tower, to the White House, to, you know, all these other kind of Trump-linked places. And Sussman says, okay, I'm gonna report this to the proper channels. And that's where that ended. And that's what was in the Durham report. Nothing illegal. In fact, Neustar wasn't even monitoring actual data. They were just looking at transfers of information, which includes a phone call. They did not listen in on any phone calls. They did not extract any data from any communications at all. They didn't even trace phone numbers, by the way. So that's that. And Sussman, of course, reported this. So Durham, in his filing, in a little part at the end of the filing, you know, additional background information is what it was mentioned. Like, that's it. It was mentioned in there. It did not accuse Sussman or Neustar or anyone else of violating any law. It never said that the Clinton campaign infiltrated Trump. Oh, and by the way, it also pointed out that this monitoring of the data actually began in 2014 to the White House. And last I checked, Donald Trump wasn't even running for president in 2014. That was Barack Obama in the White House, and they were monitoring the data then. So this actually almost is more of a Barack Obama story. Why are they monitoring Obama, right? Then why are they monitoring Trump? But all of that context was left out. And Fox News ran with the headline, Hillary Clinton infiltrated, they said, they put the word in quotes, infiltrated the Trump White House, the Trump Tower. They spied on him illegally, they say. And none of that happened. And of course, as the week dragged on, we did get real explainers. You know, CNN put one out, the New York Times put one out earlier in the week, and the New York Times pointed out that we actually talked about this back in October. We did a story on this, and it's not even a story. So why is everybody jumping on it now? Why is Trump out there and all these other right-wingers who are saying the media is ignoring this? No, y'all ignored it when we talked about it back in October, is what the New York Times was basically saying. And it's true, they did. You know why? Because there's no there. And I hate that expression, but it is totally applicable to this situation. So why are Republicans pushing this so hard? Well, for one, they hate Hillary Clinton more than they hate anything else on this planet. She is always the biggest thorn in their side. And they needed a good narrative to run with, right? They need a good villain, to be honest with you, in this year's midterms. To be honest, they can't attack Biden very much because, one, not a whole lot has happened. And most of the things he's done, let's be honest, are, you know, fairly conservative. So they really can't make him the big bad villain that they want. So bringing Hillary Clinton back gives them that. But more importantly, what's happened in the last few weeks that's looked really bad for Republicans? Trump got busted, you know, with the stories of him flushing documents down the toilet. Got busted with the 15 boxes of White House documents illegally stored at Mar-a-Lago. The January 6th committee is ramping things up. New information is coming out, all of it making the Republican Party look even worse than they already had. So the Republicans needed a distraction. That's what this story is. It's not that Hillary Clinton did anything wrong here. It's not that Sussman was illegally spying. It's that they needed a distraction. And this did. This distracted the public long enough for them to think that, oh, this might actually be something. Oh, maybe we need to look into this. Maybe we need an investigation. There is an investigation. That's what Durham's doing. But he didn't accuse anybody of any wrongdoing, of breaking any laws, or of even violating any kind of trust with what he put in that court filing last Thursday. To put it quite simply, it was a giant nothing burger, but Republicans still filled up on that buffet anyway. And the distraction didn't last too long. And that's the best part of this. Like, this story is pretty much already dying. I know there's going to be plenty of Republicans, trust me, continue trying to bring it up, trying to talk about it. It ain't going to work. But what also happened this week was that Mazars, the accounting firm that has been with Donald Trump for decades, actually came out, it was technically last week, but it made public this week, that they sent him a letter saying, yeah, we're done with you. We are no longer representing you. We are no longer going to be your accountants because the information that you've given us is unreliable. And then they went a step further. And this, of course, was obtained by the investigators in New York. And they issued a statement saying anybody that has relied on us to give them information about Donald Trump's finances, please know that that information is not reliable because what we got from him is not reliable. Now, that kind of seems like Mazars is trying to wash their hands before Donald Trump goes down. As I always say, look, I'm not optimistic that Donald Trump is actually going to go to jail. I am more optimistic now than I ever have been. This is a big move. When your accounting firm comes out publicly, but not even publicly, tells the people investigating you for potential bank and tax fraud, when they tell those investigators, his financial documents are not reliable, which is basically to say, they're filled with lies, which is exactly what the investigators are looking for. Was he lying in these financial forms? Did he lie and overestimate, overinflate the values of his property and his net worth to secure bank loans? If he did, that's bank fraud. Did he undervalue all of his properties and holdings in order to pay less in taxes? That's tax fraud. Now, Mazars, being the official accounting firm, meaning they kind of put together the finalized documents. What I believe Mazars is alluding to is the tax issue. For the bank issue, which is still a thing, I still think, you know, that's probably the big one. But with the bank issue, you don't always have to have, you know, the official accounting documents to secure a bank loan. You know, you can send them your tax returns. You can send them your business statements. You know, you can send them the property holdings. So it's actually much easier to lie to the bank than it is to the IRS. But when the IRS receives these official documents, you know, from very recognized, very reputable tax firms like Mazars, they accept what they say. They say, okay, listen, these people are the real deal. They know what they're doing. So this must be accurate. So Donald Trump pays X amount in taxes. The Trump Organization pays X amount in taxes based on the info from Mazars. So I think this is more related to the potential tax fraud issue than it would be to the bank fraud. The bank fraud, we're probably going to have to prove it somewhere else, which, again, you're going to prove that from the information they've already gotten from Deutsche Bank. So, yeah, I think the investigators in New York are pretty well set up to handle what's happening here. And the funniest part of all of this is that while that Mazar story was breaking, a federal judge in Washington, D.C. handed down a ruling that actually reversed a ruling from a couple of months ago that removed the Trump Organization and therefore the three Trump children, Junior, Eric, and Ivanka, from a lawsuit filed by Washington, D.C. Attorney General Carl Racine. Now, if you're not familiar with that one, first of all, it means you're not watching Ring of Fire on YouTube. But anyway, Racine has been investigating and is now suing over potential misuse of charitable funds from the Trump Inaugural Committee in overpaying Trump properties for the inauguration. Basically, what is being alleged here, and we have to say alleged because they have not officially been charged, it's alleged, based on evidence that is readily available, that the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C. jacked up their rates to sky-high prices for both rooms and conference rooms, ballrooms, all of that, ahead of the inauguration. And then the Trump Inaugural Committee, of course, did all their events there. They paid this inflated price. The inflated profits go back into the pockets of the Trump children. A couple months ago, a judge said, hey, listen, Carl, you've done a great job of presenting this case here, but I don't think you can include the Trump Organization on this. You know, so we're removing Trump Organization, removing Trump's kids from your lawsuit. Not going to happen because one of Donald Trump Jr.'s buddies came forward and said, yeah, I played a big role in that. They didn't. So I'm just going to take him at his word and remove the kids. And a federal judge, again, as the Mazar story was breaking, handed down a ruling that reversed that judge's ruling and told Carl Racine, no, you can absolutely include the Trump kids in this. You can include the Trump Organization. In fact, you probably need to include all of these things in your lawsuit. So Racine takes it to the media and says, we're off to trial. And yes, Eric, Ivanka, and Junior are all going to be a part of that. And Ivanka is the one, believe it or not, that is probably going to have the biggest fall here. Because Ivanka had tried to claim during a deposition, and I believe the deposition took place last year, maybe even the year before, because this has been going on. Again, we're talking about the Trump inauguration. So this has been going on for many years, this investigation and this lawsuit. So Ivanka had given a deposition where she said, look, I wasn't involved with any of the planning. You know, yeah, I knew it was happening, the planning of it, but I wasn't involved in such minute details. Well, then it was revealed through evidence that she actually was. She was so involved that she was the one that approved the menus for those evenings. Told them, no, I don't want this dish on there, put this dish on. She was involved, according to the witnesses, in every decision that came down the pipeline. So there's no way, if the hotel was in fact jacking up the prices, that she wouldn't have been the one pulling those strings. So she's in trouble. Don Jr., of course, is also heavily involved, probably more so than Eric, because he was, you know, really kind of the face of the organization running the things. And if he approved the rate hike on the rooms and then Ivanka approved the inaugural committee to pay that, I'm not sure where Eric fits in. But of course, as an executive at the company, he would also go down for this. So that's what happened in just the last 7 days, folks. So it has been quite the week of news. again, totally wild, totally ridiculous. And that, of course, is why the Republicans are trying to cling to this Hillary Clinton story, trying to cling to the big nothingness, because they need something. They need anything at all to distract the public from how horrible the behavior of the Trump family, the Trump administration, Donald Trump himself, and of course all the other Republicans has been over the last 5 years. States across the country right now are working on legislation that is going to radically transform the landscape here in the United States. And just in the last couple weeks, we have seen even more extreme legislation come out. More and more red states are putting abortion bans in place, you know, 15 weeks, 14 weeks. We have more voter suppression bills coming down the pipeline. We have bills to punish teachers for teaching critical race theory or talking about sexual identity, sexual orientation. And this is all happening because this is what Republicans want. And recently, I had the opportunity to speak with David Pepper, the author of the book Laboratories of Autocracy, where he explained how Republicans at the state level are able to basically get every single thing they want and, of course, give corporations everything they want at the same time without ever having to actually control the federal government, where most people focus all of their attention. So I wanted to revisit that interview because even though it's only 2 months old, it is so incredibly relevant and so incredibly intelligent that I think we all need that reminder right now to know what we're up against as we continue to inch closer and closer to the midterms. Here it is. David, your new book, Laboratories of Autocracy, I think that is the perfect label for what we see happening, especially just in the last few months with states around this country. But obviously, this is something that's been going on for many, many years. So lay out to us, you know, your book here and your general thesis, because I love it. I think it's absolutely brilliant.
The book walks through how these states have really become, you know, what the title says, laboratories of autocracy. And by that, I try and emphasize in the book, they're not only hacking away at the pillars of democracy, you know, independent courts, they're rigging legislative elections, they're attacking things like the teaching of history, you name it, but they really are operating as laboratories where all these states are doing this at the same time. They're always learning from each other. If one of them tries something, doesn't work, all the other states pay attention. They do it differently. If something works and is held up in court, the other states model from that. They're sharing their best practices and lessons learned. So that's why it's accelerating, because it's getting more coordinated and they're sort of perfecting something that began, you know, a few decades ago, but they're perfecting it as they go and they're operating more in unison than they ever have. So it sounds almost like a, you know, overhyped title, but my hope is when people read the book, they'll see that it's a perfect description of what's happening right now in these states.
Well, and I think if we look at obviously one of the most recent examples of this with the Texas abortion bill, because you already have, I forget the exact number, but well over a dozen Republican-controlled states that have said publicly, if the Supreme Court upholds the Texas law, we are ready to follow suit. We have the legislation essentially already drafted. We're dealing with that in Florida. We're seeing it in other states across the South. They're ready. They're just Absolutely. Waiting on that go ahead. And Texas really was just kind of the petri dish of, we'll be the ones to test it out. And if we succeed, everybody else can follow suit here.
Totally. That's how it works. And I would assume some will pass it because politics favors some of them doing this even before there's a decision. But here's the thing. If the court strikes it down, they're going to read the opinion very closely to figure out exactly how to amend the law in their own state. So the next time it gets upheld, they're always learning from successes and failures. You know, the same thing happened with Ohio's purging process. We have a horrible process in Ohio of purging infrequent voters. A lot of states held back from doing that because it looked to be violating federal law. Well, the Supreme Court upheld it 5-4 a couple years ago. Other states have now begun it. And our Secretary of State, who defended this process, literally the day they won their Supreme Court case, announced, said very proudly, we hope other states do the same thing. So they really are acting this way. And you know, it is leading to terrible outcomes like that law. But it also means that they are doing it in across the board, attacking democracy itself. And one of the things I go through in this book is a lot of things they're pursuing, like that Texas law, in a world of normal politics, they would actually lose their office. They're pushing things that are very unpopular. So one of the things they all have to do to sustain what they're doing is really crush, you know, robust democracy. Because if you tried to push all the crazy stuff they're pushing, if it was a normal election and fair districts, they'd all lose. These things are extreme. They're in the extreme minority. So one of the areas that they're all learning from each other all the time is what is the best way to crush democracy? And I opened my book with a small example. In Ohio, while drop boxes for voting early have been popular and bipartisan for years, in Ohio, the Secretary of State actually banned all but one drop box per county. It led to really long lines. It led to traffic jams. People had to drive, 40 miles to get to a drop box. In some counties of a million people, one drop box. It was a disaster. But if your goal is to keep people from voting who you don't like voting, it was a success story. What happened in the last year amid all the other stuff? A number of states are replicating this ban of all but one drop box per county. And so they always are learning from each other. And right now they are learning from each other how to best attack basic pillars of our democracy. It's obviously a very scary pattern we're seeing.
You know, it's funny to me that you pointed that out, because that was the point I was going to make as well, is that it's always the most extreme pieces of legislation here that get replicated from state to state. You know, a couple years ago, where we saw the legislation that said, hey, listen, we're going to make it legal for if a protester is blocking the flow of traffic,
right,
you're okay to essentially run them over.
Right.
And then, of course, after that passed, we started to see it pop up in the Midwest. We've seen it pop up down here where I am in Florida.
Yep.
And that is just one of so many different examples. You know, another one could be the transgender athlete bans,
right,
that we see these people pushing that is addressing a problem that doesn't actually even exist, but it panders to the base.
Right.
And for some of these, by the time a court were to come and strike it down, everybody's already forgotten it even existed. And they're not going to pay attention,
right,
to the fact that it no longer is a law. They're just going to remember it had happened. And so that's another thing they get to do. Even, you know, we see this legislation that is almost designed to fail, in some of these instances too. And that is intentional, because they know they can drum up this base. And of course, as you pointed out, learn from it, learn why it was struck down and say, okay, but we can redo it and address these couple issues the courts had, and then,
right,
we're good to go with it.
Yeah, and I call it in my book, I sort of casual about it, but the 80-20 rule. They push so much stuff forward in all these state houses. And one or two of the issues will generate all the attention. It'll actually make the newspaper. And oftentimes that issue may get beaten up so much that they actually pull back. But in the meantime, there's a lot of other issues that no one focused on that pass that actually become law. And then those issues that become law are picked up in other states. So 80% of the things they push forward may not actually make it or may be struck down. But if all the states are doing it and 20% get through in state after state, and then they all replicate each other, they're always making progress. And as I go through the book, there for a lot of reasons, people don't pay attention to these state houses. The newspapers, our state journalists are really being hurt by that industry falling apart and cuts. So there's that chaos caused by all these bills. Some get attention, others get no attention. You know, here's a great example in Ohio. We had all sorts of bills come forward, the kind you mentioned last year. Maybe the most egregious attack on democracy in my standpoint, it's happening around the country. Our legislatures are starting to attack independent elected courts. And in Ohio, we managed to win a lot of these seats, Democrats did, by running smart campaigns and good candidates. Well, amid all the frenzy of things that got a lot of attention, the Republicans passed a bill that forevermore party ID would be on the ballot for Supreme Court and appellate judges. That's never been the case before. Why do they do that? Because they don't want to have anything but courts of their own party. You know, a huge effort to stop having a court that's a check and balance almost got no headlines. So there's like in that craziness, it's almost like a different form of misinformation, create a huge mess, create a lot of controversy on one side, and on the other, slip in some things that really do hurt democracy while no one's paying attention, and then do it again and again and again.
You know, it's a great point you bring up, too, about the fact that, you know, people aren't paying as close of attention to these state house races. And part of that, of course, is absolutely the media. Even in areas where they do still have, you know, a local newspaper, they have their local news channel. Behind most of them is actually some big media conglomerate. You know, we have a local newspaper here in my small town, but it's actually a Gannett paper, and they run mostly stories that come from the parent. Our local TV channel is actually, you know, right. Sinclair Broadcasting. And so we get their propaganda coming through as well. So people are less informed, obviously, and these news outlets are focusing less and less on what's happening in your state, especially when we look at the last 5 years. Everything is national news because we came off those four horrendous years where everything Trump said, did, or tweeted, you know, was unfortunately newsworthy. And I don't think that was overhyped either. I mean, he was tweeting out horrible things, but now with COVID surging and all of this, everything that's truly affecting these state house races in an election year like this does get pushed to the side. And that's to the detriment of the American voters. And unfortunately, I think we're going to see even more of that this year, especially if the pandemic kind of keeps the rate that it's going. I know we're going to die down eventually, but if another variant comes out, that's the news. And these local races that are starting to shape up this year are going to get overshadowed again.
Yeah. I mean, the one way I'd put it is because of everything you just said, state houses are almost the Achilles heel of American governance. You know, they have a whole lot of power, and this is an important part of the book. And you know, you go back to the original Constitution, state houses are given enormous power over our democracy. You know, they choose the electors that go and choose the president. They draw the district lines of our Congress. They set the rules of elections. So they have a lot of power, but they're almost anonymous. One of my book chapters literally, with great power comes great anonymity, off that old Spider-Man quote. And the problem there is that's a really toxic and dangerous combination. They can do a lot of things, but no one knows about it. And who does know about it? The people who want them to do things with those powers that aren't good. And that's why I think you see the groups like ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, the Koch brothers. They have zeroed in on these state houses because they know they have a lot of power. They can do a lot of things, good or bad, but they can do it in a way that no one notices it. Or the elections for these state houses are so rigged by gerrymandering, even if they do them and it gets noticed, they never lose anyway. They're essentially guaranteed reelection. So it's this very unaccountable and anonymous level of government that happens to have a lot of power over economic issues, social issues, and also democracy itself. It's a dangerous combination. And that's why I wrote the book, trying to get people to pay as much attention to this level of government that can do so much damage if in the wrong hands, as opposed to, you know, we spend all day watching Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert. They not only aren't in the majority, they're not passing any laws. They make a lot of noise. There are hundreds of people just like those Congress people in state houses right now in the majority in leadership positions, passing laws, attacking democracy. We should not focus on the ones in Congress, but we should focus just as much on the ones at the state houses who actually are passing laws that really are impacting the democracy of this country.
Well, you know, you also bring up there, you've got your Koch brothers, you've got ALEC. ALEC has been at this for years because ALEC understands when you want to make real change, you do it at the state level. And part of it is because of that anonymity that you talk about. You know, what if we go and we change some rules over here in Wyoming, you know, so we can get some more fracking? Nobody's going to pay attention to Wyoming. And then, of course, we can go to another state and say, well, hey, look what Wyoming did. This opened up, created some jobs here.
Exactly.
This is great.
That works.
And the Koch brothers, too, I believe it was 2016 election. We had talked about this here on Ring of Fire. They started pouring money into city council races in Pennsylvania. And when you start to dig in a little more, it's because they were hoping to open up areas for fracking in Pennsylvania, but they were so zeroed in on it that they knew the city council members to go after. And that's the kind of thing that happens, you know, not just at the state house, but sometimes it goes even more local than that with what these particular special interest groups and big money donors are targeting. And those definitely get overlooked by the press and, of course, by the voters as well.
Yeah, no, it's true. They've been doing it a long time. And, you know, one of the things I put in my book is, you know, take a rounding error of the amount of money that we spend on the Democratic side for a presidential campaign. And if you dedicated, you know, 5% of that and said, we're going to spread it out over 4 years to cover 50 states and offices at all levels, you know, that could help you focus and elect people at the state house level or other levels. And by the way, if you did it, I think you'd actually be in better shape in the presidential election because you'll have more of an infrastructure. And my guess is people who are giving at the presidential level are thinking, well, that's crazy. We would never do that. And the answer is, well, that's what the Koch brothers did. They figured out that actually spend a little less, if at all less, in the presidential, but invest enough money in all those local races where $10,000 makes a big difference, as opposed to being a drop in the ocean at the higher level. You know, put $20,000 into a state house race. Do that in states across the country, like Ohio or others. And with the Koch brothers made that bet. And it's absolutely worked to a T. They've locked in control of state house after state house. And with the control of the state houses, they get everything they want to do economically done. All these state houses are doing trickle-down economics, deregulating everything. So they get that done. But they also now have their hands on the levers that control democracy itself, because state houses have those powers too. So their investment is paid off in spades. And on our side, we still haven't quite caught. People are catching up to it, but we're years behind the mind shift that has to happen. You know, we need to reframe how we think about politics right now for those of us who care about democracy. And that is to make it clear that that's what this is about. This is a long battle for democracy. Will we have a robust democracy, or will we have something that looks like what Hungary has now, competitive autocracy, where most things are predetermined by election rigging and gerrymandering and voter suppression? That's what the battle is. And if you think about it that way, it means you're investing in 50 states, not only swing states in a federal year. And it means you understand this is a long, long game we're fighting, not just a cycle by cycle game.
You know, I think it's also important to point out, too, when we talk about these corporations and these special interests who do pour money like this into the state house races, as you said, you don't have to spend as much. Those races typically are cheaper. And then, where do a lot of the federal politicians come from? Well, they come from the state house.
Right.
And at that point, it's almost like the big moneyed interests are buying stock. You know, we bought in when it was cheap.
Right.
And now once this person tries to go for a higher office, maybe they want to run for U.S. Congress. Maybe they want to run for Senate because they've got good name recognition in their state. We already bought into them. So right. We don't have to pump as much money into them as if they were a new person. They're already on our side. So that's another part of the investment, because these, you know, state house people typically, and I look at my district here because Matt Gaetz is my congressman.
Oh, boy.
And that's where he came from. That's where a lot of these people do come from. Ron DeSantis as well. So it's a good investment for these corporations, a horrible payout for the American public. But you buy these people cheap and you own them forever.
Yeah. And the culture that they're coming from are like Florida, Ohio, hyper-partisan, more corruption than any other level. So the breeding ground is now a place that's turning, that has people in these offices who've never really been about public service. In fact, one of the things in the book I talk about is we're now at the tail end of the first generation of politicians. And I don't know all your Florida ones, but I can say this confidently, Ohio. Most of the people in the majority of the Ohio State House have themselves never really been in a real election. The election, their district was rigged in 2011. They weren't going to lose ever. they maybe won a primary at some point, got like 6,000, 8,000 votes. Since then, they've never had an election. Democracy isn't a part of why they rose to power. And frankly, a lot of them know that. They know that if they actually were ever in a real democratic system, they're so extreme, and many of them are tied close enough to corruption, their public outcomes are not defensible. You know, towns falling apart, schools falling apart, power grids collapsing in Texas. It's all part of the same corrupt statehouse culture. In a real democracy, these people would lose. And they themselves have never actually had to win a real election. So that's the generation that's kind of coming to power. And yeah, it should scare us that a bunch of people just like that will also end up in Congress. Because if they themselves have never been through a democracy, if all they've known are rigged districts they couldn't lose, if they're in Congress and they're asked to vote on things that would protect democracy, of course they're not going to. All they've ever known is a lack of democracy. It's a really scary, and I think we're starting to see, because people always are surprised by how bad these legislatures are. And when you realize, well, it's because none of them have actually been in a democratic world their whole careers, it shows you how warped the politics gets when that's what these people have been experiencing. I had to win a city council race in Cincinnati. I won a swing county commission race. I know what it's like to go and try and win a real election and talk to the actual swing voters. These people haven't done that. And so the very notion of a competitive democratic system where they have to earn an office is foreign to them. And in the end, it scares them. And that's why they work so hard on rigging districts so they can't ever lose.
Well, you know, and you and I obviously have a little bit unique perspectives on this, because as you said, you're in Ohio. We have seen horrible legislation at the state level from Ohio. I'm down here in Florida. We have it as well. So what I do wonder, and I don't know if you even have, you know, opinions on this or not, but there is a bit of a, you know, we've experienced it, so we understand how scary it is, how threatening it can be, and what it does to democracy. Do you think there's a disconnect between some of these folks that are in, you know, the solid blue states? They don't have to go through as much of this. And so maybe they just don't think about it as much. I mean, what's your opinion on that?
The second half of my book title is A Wake Up Call from Behind the Lines. And it's actually saying, I want you to hear from people who are living in states that in many ways no longer meet a definition of a functioning democracy. I mean, that sounds dramatic, but it's true. It really is the case, at least at the statehouse level. Florida, like Ohio, I think good Democratic candidates can still win statewide, but the state houses are rigged. They can't be lost under the current situation. That's not a democracy. And I do worry that maybe folks in blue states, they've already sort of given up on states like Ohio and Florida as forever red. And I would say to them, we had a Democratic state house as recently as 2010. It's not like that was that very long ago. They rigged it in 11, so that would never happen again. And I wrote the book to explain that it's much worse than people appreciate the consequences of what's happened in these state houses, to try and wake folks up. And when I watch Washington and the fact that they put voting rights behind other key pieces of legislation, and now I see talk that maybe we'll do, you know, electoral count, college count reform instead of broader voting rights. When I see that, that's when I think they don't know how bad it is that in many of these states, you no longer have a democratic system. And that should be unacceptable. I mean, in fact, in the Constitution itself, there's a clause of the Constitution that says the United States shall guarantee a Republican form of government in every state. The founders said we must ensure there's democracy in every state of this country. And that's what I would say to anyone in a blue state. And by the way, a lot of blue state folks have had me on, and they're very concerned like we are. But I do worry that there's almost, well, that's a red state. They're going to be run by a Republican legislature. And that, too, may be true. But the result of this rigged, corrupt system is that we're not being governed like the moderate state that we are, Ohio. We're being governed like we're the most far right state in the country. It's way out of whack with where the people of Ohio are. I go through in the book, you know, everything from Roe v. Wade to gun safety. They're legislating in the Ohio State House, and I'm sure this is true in Florida, in a way that only 30% of the people support. They're on the side of the deep minority for Ohio. But because of the way the political system is set up, there's no accountability, so they can keep doing it. They don't represent Ohio, whether or not we're swing or a little bit red. What they're doing is like Alabama red or way far to the right red. It's not Ohio. But in a system of a rigged, you know, legislature, they can do it and get away with it.
Right. When you have the one party in power, the Republicans that get to at the state level change the voting laws, they get to rewrite the districts, they get to make the rules and they get to say, okay, well, look, we know we don't have a majority of the voters. So how do we make it to where our majority, as you've pointed out, stay safe? And that's what you've seen in Ohio. It's what we see in Florida. It's what they're trying to do in, you know, Georgia and Texas and all these other states that, you know, could be purple. And in fact, the population suggests it is way more purple than people realize. And then I see, you know, like what we've seen this week with Texas. Texas comes out and says, we need the federal government to help. Omicron's going crazy. We need the federal government. And you see these folks on social media saying, well, you deserve this. You're getting what you but you can't have that attitude. You cannot. You have to understand this affects everybody out there. And it drives me crazy when I see people with the, oh, well, you get what you deserve. No, this is absolutely a horrendous circumstance here. And something has to be done about it. These states are far more purple when you get down to the people than a lot of folks understand.
Here's these legislators, they don't reflect the people of their states anymore. So when I hear, well, you get what you deserve, these are people who are guaranteed re-election. I mean, I put in the book, 60 of the 99 members of the state house, 60 Republicans, for 10 years, averaged double-digit victories. Most of them averaged 20 points or more. So it's these states are no longer about the people of the states. These legislatures exist on their own, doing what they're doing, immune from the people. And that's the problem. And that's something that should trouble anyone from any state, that you have states that, at least at the legislative level, you essentially no longer have what anyone could describe as a functioning democracy. That's one reason, by the way, that when major economic interests or anti-democratic interests, when they want to get stuff done, they go through the state houses because they know these state houses will do what they ask without any worry of re-election. A mayor would probably lose election if they did some of these things because it's unpopular. So these are anti-democratic institutions. They have no connection back to the people of their states or their districts anymore. And so they become the perfect sort of breeding ground of all the worst legislation. If you want to get something really bad done, basically, you go to the state house. They'll do it and they'll never lose their election. And that's something that, again, and here's the problem. Even if you said to yourself, well, they deserve it, as the founders worried about, these state houses have enough control over the nation's democracy that by being undemocratic in states doesn't only damage the states, it risks the entire nation's democracy. And that's, in the end, the real threat, is that if these state houses continue what they're doing, they can mess with enough of the overall nation's voting that they can turn what they're doing and nationalize it. And that's why Donald Trump, who was he calling when he wanted January 6th lead to a different outcome? State houses, because they have the power over the electoral college process. And so even if you're you know, wrongly saying they deserve it, when these state houses no longer even reflect their people, the risk is even bigger than just what's happening in states themselves. It's to the entire country.
Well, and hopefully, you know, with midterms this year, obviously state house elections, well, hopefully people understand this. Hopefully we can wake some folks up. And of course, I think the best way to do that, pick up a copy of this book, Laboratories of Autocracy, a wake-up call from behind the lines. So David, real quick before we go here, tell people where they can find you, social media, whatever you got.
Thanks again for having me on. I'm very active on Twitter. You'll at David Pepper, and you can go to laboratoriesofautocracy.com and see a little bit about the book and buy it through there. I also recently started a YouTube channel as well, David Pepper for Ohio, the number for Ohio, where I try and do a lot of explainer videos about what's happening, which people seem to find helpful. So any of those places, go to them and check them out.
David Pepper, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much. Take care.
That's it for this week's Ring of Fire. But don't forget, you can help support the show and, of course, get access to all of the Ring of Fire archives. Go and sign up at ROFpodcast.com. And for Ring of Fire every single day of the week, subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. You can also support us by becoming a member of our YouTube community. When you go to our YouTube channel, click on that community tab and you'll see some wonderful tiers that you can use to not only get access to exclusive content, but to also help support us here at Ring of Fire. You can also do that via Patreon at patreon.com/TheRingOfFire. And of course, if you're so inclined, I encourage you, follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Farron Balanced. That is it for this week's show, but we will be back with you next week. Until then, have a great week, and we'll talk to you next time.